That's right. It's the Newspaper Mama. That's Corey Romora's walk-up song. You know what I mean? Like if you were coming up to the plate, Corey, you know what I'm saying? And they had to play a tune. I think that's what they call them. Don't they call them walk-up songs? That would be yours.
Yes,
the Newspaper Mama. Yes, Corey Romora from the Vintage Chicago Tribune and other things here at 720 WGN. Once again, thank goodness. 9 minutes after 8 o'clock. Well, Corey, 84 pages of Summer Olympians from the area who won gold? Yes.
I thought it would be fun. I mean, you know, we always get excited when the Olympics roll around, especially the Summer Olympics, because I know a little bit more about those sports than I do Winter Olympics.
Yeah, no, I'm not complaining. I'm just saying, well done. Very well done. And then also, 82 pages, two less, and I'm not sure why, about Millennium Park and the history of that part of town. And hopefully we can talk about all of these, right? I hope.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, no matter how long it takes.
Let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. All right. Vintage Chicago Tribune. Have you been watching any of the Olympics? You said you like these summer. Has this doing this article sort of motivated you to watch more Olympics or less?
Yeah. I enjoy watching it. It's interesting because Paris is only like 6 hours ahead of us.
Yeah.
So I feel like I already know what happened before I watched it, you know, after keeping an eye on social media all day long. But still, I want to see the situations, even when I know what the result is. But I don't always have control of the remote control in our house. So I don't get to watch as much of it as I would like to. But we did watch the entire opening ceremony. Did you watch that?
Yes, I did. And
what'd you think?
I think if you took away the boats, you eliminated all the boats and the teams, and eliminated the announcers, you'd have a great show.
I agree with that. Like, I wanted a version of it with just the narration of what was going on and what it was meant to be, you know?
Yes.
I didn't need the, that's cool, over and over and over again.
Oh, my God. Incredible. That's cool. Yeah, I know. I feel exactly the same way. Not only that, you know, if you're, I said this on Monday, say you're producing the broadcast of the opening ceremony of the Olympics. You would think, like, okay, say you're going to be broadcasting the St. Patrick's Day parade in Chicago, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're mm-hmm. the host on TV or radio or whatever. You're going to have, or Air and Water Show, you're going to have, the announcers are going to have a list of who's who, what's what the order is, and if there's any special information that the viewer / listener would be interested in. And I would think that if you're in a foreign country that's hosting the Olympics with as much heritage and history as France has and Paris has, and obviously mm-hmm. it is a foreign language, that you would supply your broadcast team with appropriate information so there would be no misunderstanding of what you were looking at. But they didn't do that.
I was disappointed, too, because I thought the boats were really cool, but when the first country started to come through, the announcers made a comment like, we're not going to give you a bunch of facts about each of these countries. And I'm like, oh, really? Because that's the stuff I look forward to. Like, there are countries I'd never heard of before.
Exactly. In fact, they weren't going to give you a bunch of
flags I had never seen before. It's like, give me some of those details instead of just like, awesome.
Oh,
you know,
look,
that's
raining.
What I think of myself doing as a broadcaster. That's how I would sound. And I'm not a professional at all.
Oh, you'd be better than that. Come on. No, the rain didn't help and everything and all that. I just, by the way, I wasn't going to read this until later, but now that we've brought it up, I got a text from 847 about 10 minutes ago that says, Mr. Landecker, your radio show is as macabre and avant-garde as the Olympic opening ceremony.
I tell you what, My son, who's 9 years old, his takeaway from that is, I want to see the part where Marie Antoinette lost her head again. Like, that was his favorite part.
That was my favorite. That was my favorite part of that whole battle that occurred after that. That was just unbelievable.
Wild.
Unbelievable. Well, we don't have enough time. Well, you know, let's take a little tiny rest. And then we'll actually get into the article that Corey from the Vintage Chicago Tribune has so graciously agreed to discuss with us here. Coming back next on 720 WGN. Corey Moore from Chicago Tribune and the Vintage Chicago Tribune with John Landecker at 720 WGN. And one of the great articles Corey has is the Summer Olympians from the area who have won gold. So let's go. And some of them not only won gold, but did things that had never been done before. And we can start out, I guess, with in 1900 with a woman named Margaret Abbott, who...
She's a fascinating story. Yeah. If you are out at a trivia night or something like that, or you want a, you know, an icebreaker, you need an icebreaker to talk to people about, Chicago golfer Margaret Abbott, in 1900, she became the first American woman to win a gold medal at the Olympics. I mean, honestly, I need to put an asterisk next to that, because this is before the Olympics started to give out medals of any color. She essentially won a gold medal in golf. And the interesting thing is, back in 1900, if you wanted to compete in the Olympics, and this one was also in France, you had to find a way to get over there. Like, it was up to you to figure out how to get over there. And so Margaret Abbott just happened to be over in Europe and heard about this golf tournament and decided she was going to enter it. And so she not only entered it, but she won. And she wouldn't, her family wouldn't know until after she died that she was the first American woman to win an Olympic event. It's crazy.
I know. What an achievement, too. I mean, when I'm reading these, we'll get to some of the other instances where on the surface you go, oh, hey, that sounds great. But then there's so much behind the story, so to speak. I mean, what we were talking about with Margaret Abbott is the first American woman to win anything at a game. And then in 1904, explain this to me. Charles Dvorak, who's on the pole vault. So I'm reading your article, like, he went once and then wasn't allowed to compete, and then he went back 4 years later? Is that what I get out of this?
Yeah. He went in 1900, but didn't medal. And then I don't think he here's what happened. He went in 1900.
Yes.
This is a crazy story.
Right.
He was told that... And this, again, in France. France has hosted so many Olympics, by the way. It's crazy. I don't know why France, but I guess it makes sense. Anyway, he shows up to compete in the pole vault in 1900, but it was on a Sunday. So he's told by organizers, come back tomorrow. It's the Sabbath. We will reschedule it for Monday. So he and other American athletes leave the competition area, and guess what happened? They decided to have the competition without him. So he clearly was angry about this, and so he was given an opportunity to compete along with other athletes who missed out on the event. And he was given kind of a consolation prize. He was given a silver medal as a consolation prize. So after he was all bummed about that, he went to the Olympics in St. Louis in 1904, and that's when he finally took home gold. And the interesting thing about it, which I didn't realize, pole vaulters, you know, there are different types of poles that they can use. And he's considered the first pole vaulter to use a bamboo pole instead of like a heavier wood pole.
Right. That's 1904 and 1900, Charles Dvorak. And then in 1912, Harry Hebner wins a medal in swimming, but then there's something unique about him too.
Yes, you know what? Something I found out about a lot of these athletes who went to the Olympics, you know, in the early 1900s, they competed not just in one event or even one discipline. Like, they competed in multiple things, and the name Harry Hebner is probably not familiar, but the name Johnny Weissmuller sure is, right?
Yeah.
And so they were actually teammates on this group called the Illinois Athletic Club, which, look it up, back in the day, if you wanted to be a swimmer, a very good amateur swimmer, you competed to be on the Illinois Athletic Club team. Mm. And so Hebner and Weissmuller went to the Olympics for swimming, but also water polo. How cool is that?
Right. And, as you say in the article, and I found this amazing, Hebner was the first one to use the crawl stroke in the competition, which is like, what? The first to use the crawl stroke?
Yeah.
My God, that's insane. It boggles the mind, so to speak, but I guess somebody had to start somewhere. And thank goodness you. And then that's not enough, we're just starting. 1924, Sybil Bauer, swimming, goes to Schurz High School, does the backstroke, but then there's something about her that is groundbreaking, so to speak, in the history of the Olympics.
Right? Yeah. She, again, part of this Illinois Athletic Club, mm-hmm. and around the same time as Johnny Weissmuller and Harry Hebner, she traveled to Bermuda in October of 1922, and that's where she became the first woman to beat a world record that had been held by a man.
Amazing.
She finished, it was a 440-yard backstroke. She was a backstroke specialist,
right,
in 6 minutes and 24 seconds, and that was 4 seconds faster than the record that had been held by a man. She was incredible swimmer, incredible athlete. While she went to Northwestern University, she also played basketball. She played field hockey. She was the president of the Women's Athletic Association on campus.
Wow.
But something even more interesting is who she was engaged to and who she was willing to give up swimming for, she told the Chicago Tribune. Ed Sullivan, as in the Ed Sullivan Show.
Ed Sullivan? You're
kidding.
Isn't
that wild?
That is wild. Wow.
But hers is a sad story. She got sick not long after she and Ed Sullivan became engaged, and it turned out she had an aggressive form of cancer, and she died at the age of 23. It's one of those stories where she was so strong, so powerful, held, I think at one point, she held all existing records for women in the backstroke.
Wow.
So it's one of those stories where you wonder if she had been healthy and continued to swim, what could have happened?
So that was 1922, right?
Yes, 1924.
Oh, 1924. Okay, I did get that right. Because the next one's 1924, too, and that's Jackie Fields in boxing, which is no longer an Olympic sport.
Is there not doing boxing in the Olympics anymore?
I would have heard about it, I think, by now. I mean, it was for. I speak out of turn, but I haven't heard anything about Olympic boxing in a while.
I just Googled it.
It is still in there?
Apparently.
My bad.
Apparently.
Really,
you know what? You're right. It's an old sport. I mean, even before we had professional football in Chicago, boxing was a huge thing.
Oh, no, I know that.
Competition.
Oh, yeah, my God. How come we haven't heard about American boxers then? I haven't heard any coverage about
there aren't
boxing.
Any good ones.
Well, I mean, I haven't heard about the event at all.
Well, it looks like the men's featherweight round of 16 was completed already. And tomorrow,
you know what,
women's
Ben?
Flyweight.
You need to get, have you seen, I'm sorry, I'm talking over both of you.
No, that's tomorrow, women's flyweight.
Oh.
So, yeah,
and,
boxing is, yeah, it is. My bad.
NBC has something, too, where it's called Gold Zone, and it will show you, like, up to 16 different sports or events that are going on at the same time. So, you know, I haven't seen boxing yet either, but I've seen a whole lot of ping pong and a whole lot of team handball.
Well, I apologize for not for all you boxing fans for not knowing that boxing was still an Olympic sport. So here's one. Here's something that's no longer done at the Olympics, but in 1932. Joseph Webster got a medal for what, Corey?
Art.
Art.
Yes.
Art. You know, like painting, drawing, sculpting, poetry.
Yes.
Architecture.
It was kind of like a state fair type thing, you know, like, yeah, who can make the best painting and who can make the best, like, charcoal print of something. And yeah, architecture, all of the above. I guess the organizers of the modern Olympics wanted sports and art to go hand in hand. And so Joseph Webster Glinken, I tried to find some of his artwork online, and it was kind of hard, kind of difficult. I don't think it was prolific. There wasn't even a Wikipedia page for him. So I don't know how well he's known. But one of the things he was really good at was for drawing sport scenes, especially boxing. And so he actually won the gold medal. He went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. That's his Chicago connection. And won a gold medal in 1932. In mixed graphic arts for a boxing piece of art called leg scissors. So yeah, and from what I could read up about it, art remained a competition in the Olympics, I think, until the early 1950s.
I don't remember. Well, that doesn't mean anything that I don't remember it. But okay, the early 1950s. I'll that'd be fine if I don't remember it, because I was like, you know, almost an infant, just out of infancy.
Exactly.
It started in 1912 and went for almost four decades. It's like, and now, here on the medal stand, I mean, we have a gold medal for art, we have a bronze medal, we have a silver medal from art. I mean, what an art. That's so French. It strikes me, that is so French.
And everyone is sitting around smoking a Galois.
You know, and we're going to give away, we're going to have a medal for cheese. We're going to have a cheese medal.
I love it. Let's go, John. We can make this happen.
I have a gold in the fromage competition. There's a... we have some more folks who have made Olympic history in the Summer Games, who are from the greater Chicagoland area. And we also are going to take a look at Millennium Park and the history of that area of town, because I didn't realize it until I read it from your article that this is the 20th anniversary of Millennium Park. Wow.
Yeah.
My how time flies when you're a bean. Chicago Tribune, Corey Moore, and right now we're talking about people from the greater Chicagoland area who got medals in the Olympics. And that, of course, is the heavy metal band that came on after the head spoke. Marie Antoinette's head had a few things to say, and then that band started. One of my favorite parts of the entire ceremony. At any rate, where are we here? We left off at 1932 with Joseph Webster and art, so that we jump ahead to 1960. Terry McCann gets a medal in wrestling. You know, there's a couple of these, I didn't count, but Schurz High School pops up a few times over the course of these Olympics, doesn't it?
To look into why that is. Like, did they have an exceptional sports
must have had
program?
Something, yeah. They must have something. Yeah. Neat. So what can you tell us about Terry McCann, Kelvin Park, Schurz High School?
Yeah. He was about as tall as me, 5 feet, 4 inches, and he really wanted to wrestle at the University of Iowa. So, the problem was he wasn't a very good student. Mm-hmm. So he had to work really hard in the classroom and on the mat, and ended up earning All-American honors and NCAA titles at Iowa. And what I thought was interesting, he graduated from Iowa with a degree in business administration, and by then he was already married and had two small kids, and eventually he and his wife would have 7 kids. So it's like, oh my gosh, this guy was busy. He had a lot going on.
Sounds like he was really good at wrestling. You know I mean?
Hi-oh.
Hey, now. Try the veal. Okay. Well, you know, Iowa... Iowa has always had, I believe, a really strong wrestling program, by the way.
You're exactly right. Yes, yeah. I have a wrestler who lives on my block, and he really wanted to go to Iowa and goes there for camps and during the summer for wrestling. Right. So, yeah. Really good school.
Now we're going to get in. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just one more thing about him he helped establish USA Wrestling. He was so committed after winning the gold medal in Rome in 1960. He still was very involved with wrestling. And so, yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about writing this to me was there were so many names I had never heard of before, but these people were, they had worked very hard and they were groundbreakers in a lot of ways.
Well, you know, you make a good point there because we immerse ourselves in these Olympics, but then you consider how many athletes from around the world there are and how many different events there are, how many medals there are, how many names would be on that list, and then what percentage of them will actually ever be remembered. I would think it would be a very, very small percentage.
You know what I mean? Isn't that so sad? Because I think, you know, in watching, like, Simone Biles, like, she's
She'll be remembered. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, like you said, Terry McCann, a wrestler, I had never heard of him, and people should hear about him, and so it's a good thing he wrote about it. I mean, it was 1960, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, and
pretty
then...
recent.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for saying so. And then, as I say, you know, just as soon as I say we don't remember, then there are people like 1984, Bart Connor... from Morton Grove, Niles West, gymnastics, come on. Everybody knows him.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And you know what's interesting? I am familiar with the name Bart Connor and that he was a gymnast. I had no idea he grew up around here. And
yes.
That year, 1984, he was the youngest member of the U.S. Olympic team that year. And he had also made the team in 1980. Well, actually, in 76, he made it as the youngest. He made the team in 1980, but he didn't medal at either of those. So it took until the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles that he, apparently one of his specialties is the parallel bars.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of did the same thing that the oh gosh, I forget the guy's name, but just the other night on the pommel horse for the the American men's gymnastics.
The kid who took off his glasses and became Superman, that guy.
I mean, isn't
Steven,
that
Steven,
a great story?
Stephen, N-E-D-O-R-O-S-C-I-K-S, Nedor. Well, never mind.
I wish I knew how to pronounce his last name. Because
anyway, but yeah, that is a great story. That story.
Isn't that a great story?
Horse.
And so it was similar with Bart Connor. He was coming back from a really serious injury and just delivered this beautiful, flawless performance on the parallel bars and helped the men's team secure its all-around gold medal. And for that time, you know how we talked about the other night, it had been, what, like 16 years or something like that?
80 years.
Oh, my God.
80 years since they won a medal in the men's gymnastics, the team. 80 years.
Isn't that just wild? Just wild.
And not only that, of course, the footnote to this is that there was a Russian gymnast named Nadia Comaneci who scored perfect 10s in gymnastics in the Olympics, and they married Bart Connor and Nadia Comaneci.
Yes, and she was actually part of the opening ceremonies. She was in the speedboat with Serena Williams.
I missed
and,
that.
Gosh, oh, did you miss that part? I know, there was so much. You know what we had to do is we had to record it and just like skip through some parts of it, you know, so we could watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
I
met her once. She was a guest she was a guest on a show I had here in Chicago in like, I don't know, 1998. Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, you know, being around when she achieved what she achieved, it was an international sensation, this kid.
Yeah.
So that was very cool. Then we go to 1992. Mike Connolly out of Luther South and doing the triple jump.
Yeah, triple jump. So this is where it's a track event, and you're yes. running as fast as you can. It's like long jump, but you gotta you take 1, 2, 3 leaps, and then you jump, or 1, 2, 3 steps, and then you jump into the pit of sand. And yes. so, Mike Conley was a Luther South High School graduate. He had won silver in 1984 Olympics, but then missed out on the 1988 Olympics. So by the time he made it to the 1992 Olympics, he already had 2 sons. One was named Michael, and the other was named Jordan, as in Michael Jordan.
How about that?
And I thought this was interesting. In triple jump, they record the wind speed. And if the wind speed is above a certain threshold, then your jump does, at the time you make your jump, then it does not count. Hmm. So he actually did this amazing jump, but they said, nope, the wind was too strong. We're not going to count that one. But it was on a different jump that he actually was able to secure the gold medal. So he's really interesting. And actually, he became an agent in later years. And his son, Mike Conley Jr., was an Ohio State point guard. And then he was drafted 4th in 2007 by the Memphis Grizzlies. So a son, also athlete.
Yeah. Now, speaking of basketball, 2021, here's somebody who has already won, and again, mm-hmm. more than likely, will win in this Olympics, and that is Jewel Lloyd.
Yeah, so here's another Niles West, just like Bart Connor. This is yep. interesting, John, how you yep. picked up on Schurz and now Niles West. Jewel yeah. Lloyd grew up in Lincolnwood and became the Niles West career scoring leader. And you're right, she actually made it to the last Olympics and was with the team that won the gold there.
Yep.
In case you're wondering, U.S. women have won every gold medal in women's basketball since the 1996 Olympics. So you're yeah. right, John. It's looking pretty good for them this year,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
So hopefully she can win another. And a cool thing about her is she and her brother have opened up a smoothie shop in Lincolnwood because she wants to be an entrepreneur as well as playing for the Seattle Storm in the WNBA.
That is such a great story.
It's pretty cool.
It's very cool. See, this is the kind of thing you get out of a Cora Moore and a Chicago Tribune, vintage Chicago Tribune, and we'll do more with Corey when we come back on 720 WGN. 847 here at 720 WGN. We're talking to one of our good friends, Corey Moore from the Chicago Tribune and her vintage Chicago Tribune. And we've gone through the article about the Olympic medalists who have been in the greater Chicagoland area. And now, my friends, it's time to go on to it's the 20th anniversary of the Bean. And Corey's article goes all the way back to the 1830s to 1851. What's that got to do with it? Come on now.
Know the history of the site where Millennium Park is, like what right. used to be there, and we can go back even further, but if you go back further than that, it's just water. There was just water there, and so it's in the 1830s that the construction of the Illinois and Michigan Canal began, and that's when waterfront land started to be seen as really valuable.
Right.
And so that's when the lakefront began to be a very big deal. And people were just buying up parcels of this land in the mid-1850s. And so, but the cool thing about it is in 1835, there are notes from a meeting in 1835. So this is before Chicago even was officially a city.
Right.
People saying we need to make sure that the waterfront remains accessible to all people. Everybody deserves to have a piece of it, to be able to enjoy it. And it's funny because we hear that later with Daniel Burnham and his plan of Chicago.
Yes.
Essentially the same thing.
Yes.
That the lakefront needs to be free and open to everyone. So it's interesting. You go back to the 1830s, and that was kind of the first time we hear that idea.
So somebody obviously was buying up enough land that enough people who didn't have that money and didn't have that land were worried about it. Otherwise, why would they say such a thing?
Exactly. You know? And yeah. So there were Native Americans on a lot of this land. But after signing the Treaty of Chicago in 1833, a lot of Native Americans moved away from the area. And the land was supposed to be sold by the federal government. And so this is when a lot of speculators move in and started to scoop up these parcels.
Right.
So really the lakefront was in danger of being owned and snippets by a bunch of different people.
There's people who still hold on to that idea that perhaps the lakefront should be, you know, more accessible to everybody. But that's another story. So we go to 1852, your article, and it's significant because it's the arrival of the railroad.
Okay, so this is interesting. In the city, the people in charge of the city wanted a railroad to come through. They just didn't want it through the middle of the city. So...
They decided,
and this is just like 20 years after people of the city got together and said, lakefront should be free and open to everybody. And just 20 years later, it's, go build your railroad out into the water. And so this is when we see some of the first development was because of the railroad. This was the Illinois Central Line.
Yeah.
And so, and it's all because they just didn't want it going through downtown Chicago. So this is when you start to have these man-made things filling up, the landfill along the lakefront.
Right. And then you have the Chicago Fire from October 8th to the 10th. That certainly didn't help, I imagine. I mean, of course it didn't. I mean, that had to be a setback for everyone.
When you have like 3 miles of charred buildings, where do you put all that stuff? And so a lot of it ended up in the lake. And as a result of that, you know, you got the railroad and then people are shoving this stuff into the lake. So it's the lakefront is starting to extend even further out into the water.
Right. I didn't know that. Wow. Now there's I knew that they used landfill, but I didn't realize that part of it was the rubble from the Chicago Fire. That's a very interesting factory that I was not aware of. There's another item that you can use around your for a conversation starter. So you say in the article, in the early 1900s, it's Chicago's front lawn. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So this is the age of Daniel Burnham unveiling his plan of Chicago. And also this is when you have Aaron Montgomery Ward, the mail order magnate, saying he wants the lakefront to be preserved as park space. So we're kind of getting back to, lakefront is valuable, but it needs to be open to everybody. So we're just continuing along with that idea. And people have different ideas of things that should be done on the lakefront.
Well, you know, we were talking about the railroad. October 6th, that's not that long ago, 1977, the Garden of Arts is eyed for a railroad site. So what's going on? What's going on here? I mean,
this is kind of the first time. So through the years, Illinois Central just expands along the lakefront. They have a switching yard. They have all of these tracks. And the last thing you want to see in, you know, that close to the lakefront is train tracks. And so one of the ideas to beautify the area was to build a music venue. And what they came up with was a band shell that was kind of inspired by the Hollywood Bowl in California. But they wanted it to go over the railroad tracks. But when they found out how much it would cost, they thought, And, you know, to kind of like, if there were some way to build it above the railroad tracks so you don't see the railroad tracks, and you have music instead. But they realized how expensive that would be, and there was no way that was going to happen. So they put up, this was intended to be a temporary band shell, but it ended up lasting, I think, for a while. Let me see here. It started in the 1930s, and then I think it was there until the 70s.
And, you know, you were talking about the Illinois Central. In 1996, for unused property, they sued the city of Chicago.
Yes. Now, this is really interesting. Somebody who worked at the city, the Chicago Park District General Counsel, he was wondering, you know, why are these train tracks allowed to be here? Mm-hmm. So he started to look into who actually owns that property. And the agreement that had been struck way back when, in 1852, when the Illinois Central Railroad was allowed to build that one track out into the lake, yeah. It stipulated that as long as they're in use, they can own the property. But Daley's, by then we have the second Mayor Daley mm-hmm. in City Hall, and he got his legal team to work on it, and they filed a lawsuit saying, hey, you're not using this property anymore. The city deserves it. Mm-hmm. And so that finally cleared the way for an idea for a park, which would eventually become Millennium Park.
And then pop up 1930, 1998, Daley unveils plans for a Millennium Project, they called it, the Lakefront Millennium Project.
I mean, people loved it. His whole idea was we're going to have it ready by the year 2000, the summer of 2000. That's why they called it the Millennium Project.
Yes.
But I think we soon realized it was going to become, in the rush to get it built, it was going to become way more expensive. The plans were going to be changed many times. And so by August 2001, people are wondering, what did we get ourselves into? Like, is it worth the cost? And so, actually, the park wouldn't even open until 2004.
July 16th, and then it wasn't. Then it was 2006 when the Bean came into existence, right?
Exactly. The Bean was around. It just wasn't finalized. It was kind of in these pieces. It wasn't seamless yet. So the Bean had to go through a lot of work, a lot of repairs, before it finally looks the way it does now.
Today. Wow. And there you have the rest of the story from Corey Rumor of the Vintage Chicago Tribune. So, you know, I want to encourage everyone to get the Vintage Chicago Tribune directly deposited into your email box. And how would one go about that, Corey?
Well, I'm so glad you asked, John. You just have to go to chicagotribune.com/newsletters. I'm the one that says Vintage Chicago Tribune. You can just click that one, and I'll be in your email inbox every Thursday. You don't need a Tribune subscription to subscribe to it. It's totally free. So if you're interested in Chicago history, sign on up.
Why, that would be tomorrow then.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, tomorrow's Thursday already. I better get moving.
Yes, you better. Thanks, Corey. It's always good to talk to you, and I can't wait to see what comes into my email box tomorrow. Thanks for being with us again.
Oh, right back at you, John. Thank you so much.
You bet.